And so I didn't want to mess around with what was there, actually for fear that I might misinterpret something or misconstrue something or sort of make logical leaps that weren't true to her life.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Danielle Geller about her debut memoir, Dog Flowers, a book not only about her relationship to her late mother, absent for so much of her childhood, but about the strength and complexity of familial ties. Dog Flowers recounts with stark detail and emotional depth Geller's return home to the Navajo Reservation to confront her family's history and to retrace her mother's life, using both personal narrative and an archive of photographs and diary entries. Danielle, welcome to The Right Question.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here too. Will you begin by reading an excerpt from your memoir, Dog Flowers? Perhaps one of your favorite passages or one you're proud of craft-wise, maybe just something to give listeners a bit of context.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be reading Creator, which is the opening of the book. And it's been the opening through every draft. So it's one of the things that have survived many changes. But here's Creator. My mother spent the last 6 months of her life homeless, sleeping in a park in Lake Worth, Florida. We had not spoken to each other at all in that time. But when the hospital called to tell me she was dying, I booked a flight from Boston and arrived in Florida the next morning, too late. She would not wake the 2 days I sat by her side. My mother's on-again, off-again lover, Dale, met me at the hospital and told me he was holding on to her things, that I could go through them and take whatever I wanted. In Dale's closet, I found my mother's life packed into 8 suitcases, which, by the very nature of their design and state of disrepair, told the passing of time. Most were filled with clothes she had picked up at thrift stores, and that was where they would return. But in the oldest, an 80s soft-shell leather case with wide straps and massive buckles, I found her diaries, her photos, and the letters she kept. I found a few undeveloped disposable cameras. I found a green corduroy purse filled with dried sage bundled into smudge sticks. I found the bandana she wore on the days she skipped washing her long black hair. I found 2 crooked potholders she had crocheted. I found sterling silver and turquoise jewelry I set aside for my sister, Eileen, who was hitching rides on semis and freight trains across the West. She wouldn't make it to the hospital in time. I gathered the pieces of my mother's life and packed them into the newest suitcase, a navy blue carry-on, to bring home with me.
Danielle, how do you see Dog Flowers, what your mother called muddy paw prints, you know, tracked through the snow or through the house, representative of this memoir as a whole, and maybe even more broadly than that? How are they representative of your mother, who she was as a person?
Yeah, you know, growing up, and I was always on the outside of my mother's life, in part because she left when I was very little, and I was adopted by my dad's mother. And, you know, when I was about 10 years old, we moved from Florida to Pennsylvania, and we didn't go back to Florida during that time. And so I would get these phone calls very infrequently. And she would just sort of tell me about what was going on, but really vaguely. But as I got older, she started opening up a little bit more. And she would tell me these stories about these men that she was dating. And I could never really understand the life. It felt like the life she had chosen for herself. And part of losing her and then part of writing this book was trying to understand who she was in relation to not just me, but also the men in her life. And so as I sort of like started digging into that and hearing these stories about her, I started to realize sort of like more about her worldview and the way that she saw things and her ability or capacity to see beauty in like people who I think have been like largely rejected either by society or by their own families. And some of that was this drive in her to take care of other people. But that moment with her boyfriend, I see these like muddy paw prints, and he tells me that she called them dog flowers. It just really reinforced that understanding of just like the different way she had of like walking in the world.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, and I might slaughter the pronunciation of this, but respect défense, the chronology of ownership, custody, or location right. of a historical object. How does this principle guide, or how did it guide the writing of Dog Flowers? And maybe you can talk a little bit about the paratext that the book includes.
Yeah. So when my mom passed away, as I sort of read from Creator, I inherited all of her things, like her diaries and everything. And when I first brought them home, I just left them in that suitcase. I like, first the suitcase was like leaned up against the coffee table in my apartment. And then I didn't touch it. And then my roommates like shuffled it off into the corner of the room. And it's still, you know, I think like a couple of weeks or almost a month before I finally opened it up. Once I did, I had this, we call them banker's boxes, but like these archival cardboard boxes. I had a stack of acid-free manila folders. I had my pencil. And I was like completely ready to tackle it as almost an archival project, right? Where I'm not really trying to organize it by any like subject or any like preconceived idea of how a person would organize it, you know, because I have my own systems, you know, like I'm like, oh, my financial records have to go here, my medical records have to go here, you know, I have ways of organizing my life. And the ways that I organize my life, which actually honestly is usually in stacks of, you know, of piles of whatever around my house, says something about who I am and what I prioritize. And you know that like the way that we live our lives is often reflected in like the way that someone might come across them. So when I was going through my mom's things, I had this in mind, like what did she have and how did she use it? Or like, how did those items stand in relation to one another? When I was organizing it, I'd sometimes do it by date. You know, I had all of, and her diaries were kept in appointment books rather than like actual diaries. And so, you know, it was paired with things like, oh, like had this for dinner, or somebody owed me this amount of money. And like one day, you know, she was like really sad, or someone had broken up with her, or she'd broken up with someone else. And it was her whole life all mingling on those like pages of this appointment book. And even the gaps where she wasn't recording anything, some of those gaps said something too. And, you know, the earliest diary / appointment book that I found was the year after I was born. And so, for example, she and my dad got into a fight. He'd gotten physically abusive with her. And my grandmother, his mom, and my mom had sort of worked together to get him into treatment and to try and support his sobriety. So neither he or my mom were drinking. And for a while, she was like counting down the days, or counting up the days, I guess, you know, like Mike's been sober this long, you know, 42 days, sort of tracking. And then it stops. And, you know, you just know that he started drinking again. But there's this huge gap in time where she isn't recording anything after that point. And that silence and sort of the record, and I'm making little air quotes, like the record carried so much weight, like that sort of gap or silence. And similarly, you know, like I would find these stacks of all the letters that my sister and I had written to her all together. And they were sort of kept separate from my half sister, who was much younger than me, like the things that my mom had with her. And so I didn't want to sort of like thinking about that archival principle, mess around with what was there for fear that for fear that I might misinterpret something or misconstrue something or sort of make logical leaps that weren't true to her life.
Well, I want to talk about these objects then, because I'm wondering how much now that your mother has passed, how much of your relationship to your mother is tethered to these objects, to something of hers that you hold on to?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because honestly, you know, even as I was working on the book, I had this thought in mind of like, what do I do with these things? Because I'm treating them as an archivist, as if, but I don't pretend or actually believe that they belong outside of the family. And so to a certain extent, I think they belong in my family, and I'm just almost like the custodian or the steward or whatever word you would want to use. And I think a lot of families have those, the people who are most interested in, you know, the genealogy of the family or the history and like keeping track of who the grandparents were and the great grandparents and sometimes the great great grandparents. And so I think that's me. But at the same time, you know, I've had this thought of like, maybe one day I just destroy them, you know, like maybe one day they go up in a fire, because I don't actually believe that my mother lives in those documents. And maybe it's because I don't actually find comfort in those things. And, you know, like when I miss my mother, I don't immediately run to them looking for her, because I know, and maybe it's through this process of working on this book, I know she's not there. Like the woman that I remember and that I love, she's not there.
Do you cling to those things? Like, it sounds like you have almost a compulsion or a temptation to go to them for that connection, but then you have to kind of double back and say, actually, no, this is not where I find comfort. And then you reach elsewhere, perhaps just, you know, with kind of like intangible memories. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. They've moved with me. You know, they moved from Boston to Tucson. And then when I got married and moved to Canada, like I didn't trust to ship them. So I packed them into the car that I drove from Tucson up to Toronto. And they came with me from there to my new home in Victoria. But mostly they live in a closet. Like mostly I just make sure they're like up off the ground. They're as safe as they can be. But I don't often go back to them. And when I do, it's because I remember something that's there and I'm looking for something specific that's there. But especially since I stopped working on the book, I've looked through the photos a couple times, but yeah, haven't really spent a lot of time with them.
I think it might be where I am in my life, but I'm certainly gravitating towards a lot of people who are writing about grief. Something that I'm understanding from all of these writers who are writing about grief and through grief is that one book doesn't cover it.
No.
And so I'm wondering, are you still writing about your mother? Are you writing about your father? Where are you, you know, in the next phase of adapting, you know, this grief or your life?
You know, honestly, I was still, after I finished working on Dog Flowers, it felt like there were some things that I hadn't quite finished working through or that I was thinking about differently. Because that's the thing about a book, right? Is like the book ends, but you keep living your life, or I guess a memoir ends and you keep living your life. And also like your mind keeps turning things over and your perspective changes. But more recently, I think my loss of my dad has sort of like taken over some of my thoughts. And to a certain extent, like, do I want to write another book about losing a parent? Because, you know, it was Dog Flowers was a thing that lived in my head like for 6 years. And I think partly it's because my loss of my mother lived in my head, because I had never really found a way to mourn her loss in a way that I wasn't carrying it with me. And I think I'm still trying to find that with my dad and losing him and figuring out what all those feelings are, like how to move past that loss. So yeah, I'm sort of loosely working on a book about video games and my relationship with video games and how I've used them in the past as an often unhealthy coping mechanism. But my dad was the one that introduced me to gaming and games, and those are some of my best memories, was playing video games with him when I was younger. And so, yeah, it's about video games, it's about addiction, but it's also about my dad, and I've realized I can't escape that.
In a passage about your father, you write, "I couldn't help but feel that I would never escape my father, that a piece of him was lodged somewhere inside me and I would never dig it out." Daniel, do you think it's possible to dig our parents out of ourselves, or do we just get more and more comfortable with the irritation, kind of a sand oyster situation, so to speak?
You know, when I was writing Dog Flowers, part of it was also I was at a point in my relationship with my father. You know, when I moved to Tucson a year later, I'm like working on this book in my MFA program, and my dad like gets kicked out of my grandmother's again, and like all this crazy stuff happens, and my family like sticks him on a train and sends him to me. That just kept happening, you know, like I had to keep putting myself in the position of caretaker to this man who really at that point in his life should have been able to take care of himself. And because of my relationship with him and his relationship with my sister and his relationship with my mom, his like history of violence and abuse, I didn't want to spend time with him on the page. Like I really tried very hard to not write about him because it felt like he took up such a disproportionate amount of our collective time and energy. But I also couldn't erase him because of that same fact. When I got married and moved to Canada, even though I'd already sort of put a lot of distance between me and my dad, and he had moved to California and he was living in San Jose, in Canada, I was like, finally, like they can't put him on a bus or a train. Like he can't come here. And instead of feeling like a relief, it just filled me with a sense of like guilt or like that I had abandoned him somehow. I think that's the thing that I am trying to work through now, is this idea that he got sick, he died. You know, like no one was taking care of him these last couple of years, even though rationally or logically, I know that wasn't my responsibility. I still believed that it was my responsibility. I still felt it was my responsibility. And so letting that idea go has been really hard. I think my process of for grieving my father, you know, like thinking about it like objectively or like casting myself into the future, is being able to let go of that guilt or that sense of obligation or responsibility. I think that his loss will be easier to carry if I can do that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Danielle Geller, author of the memoir Dog Flowers. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What does it mean to be ghost sick?
It really is an unhealthy response to loss. It's becoming possessed or becoming obsessed with who the person was that is now gone. You know, this inability to let that idea go and fill your own mind with, like, I guess, what could have been or what should have been or how things could have been different. Yeah, ghost sick is just a way of understanding like the pathology behind it or sort of the unhealthy way that I was trying to grieve my mother and the way that I found out of it. And I needed that language, you know, from like the Navajo belief system, from my mother's connection to her home. And I hadn't I hadn't found something in English or in, you know, like this Western culture that resonated the same way or that explained that feeling, that thing that I was experiencing.
Well, you mentioned your mother's culture, the Navajo. You know, ghosts and spirits inhabit dog flowers in a very big way. And that includes explicit mention of skinwalkers, which you write, and I'm paraphrasing, that they were to be believed in, but not talked about. Why include skinwalkers in your memoir? What should readers and listeners understand about them in relationship to you and these stories that you're telling?
I've really struggled with spirituality and belief systems of many kinds. And so coming into that space with my sort of like natural or inherent skepticism, I really struggled to believe in those stories as like something actually supernatural or something beyond what I could explain through my own experiences or the laws of nature or however you want to put it. And from that perspective, to a certain extent, my interpretation was that when people are accused of being skinwalkers, it's a way for a community to essentially othering people whose behavior or past experiences, usually it's behavior, is monstrous to you or is other from you. Or, you know, it's a way in a community to protect itself from members who aren't following the norms or even like, you know, being good people. And so from my perspective, it was a way of sort of like casting people out. And many people in my family have been accused of being skinwalkers. And partly it's because of like their behavior and choices they made. But there are reasons behind it. And I think that that's the danger of using that language. It is not being able or willing to extend empathy for other people who might be struggling or the reasons why they might be doing the things that they're doing. So for me, that was sort of the dynamic that I was bumping up against. You know, like a person who called you a skinwalker, you might turn around and say, no, they're the skinwalker, because, you know, you've just reached a point where there is no understanding. There's no way of like meeting each other at any kind of mutual understanding. So my project was, in many cases, to try and understand these people whose motivations or actions I couldn't understand. And so in some ways, I didn't have room in my ideology to engage with this idea, while at the same time, you know, I walk a very careful line of outright dismissing anyone's beliefs and also acknowledge that there were like some really uncomfortable, scary things that happened while I was there with my family that I couldn't necessarily explain.
Danielle, you begin the third section of Dog Flowers with an excerpt by Deborah Magpie Erling. In the book, you cite, and I'll read the passage, "A woman without her people, a woman who can never return home, is crazy with grief and always longing. I am that woman. Even the crazy moon is lonely." How do you feel Deborah's work, and perhaps especially or specifically this excerpt from her forthcoming The Lost Journals of Sacagawea, how do you feel like it represents the experiences that you're drawing out in Dog Flowers?
Yeah, so I came across that book in the special collections at the University of Arizona, and it was one of those lines or like pages that I had like taken a photo of, and I kept coming back to it because it completely captured the way I was thinking about my mother and my connection to her family and this intense feeling of isolation and loneliness that I was experiencing and often still experience. Like, I think loneliness is the one emotion that I need to find a solution or an answer to, because because I feel it so persistently and so deeply. Yeah, part of it is like human connection or attachment. And, you know, I keep moving, but then I also, you know, have experienced a lot of loss, whether, you know, it was my step-grandpa when I was younger. It was like my stepmom when my dad was like living with us in Pennsylvania. It was my mom. It was my dad. It's been friends, like friendships. And sometimes I'm the root of those disconnections or loss, right? Like I've struggled with mental health issues all my life and I have bipolar disorder, and it can be really difficult to sustain or maintain relationships with people. There's an amount where like I feel like I am that crazy moon, like I've sort of put myself in a position of isolation, and I'm really trying to find myself, my way out of it.
We haven't really talked about her at all in this conversation, but I'm really curious about your sister, and maybe not about your sister specifically, but I'm wondering, when you hear the term sister, what feelings arise in you?
That's a really good question. I think there's this feeling of like the first sensation is like this sparkly feeling of like possibility almost of what I think a sister could be. But then there's also this immediate almost weight of again, like responsibility or obligation. Because I think I've been in a position for a very long time where I was made to feel responsible for my sister, my younger sister. And, you know, I have one sister that I grew up with, and then I have two half-sisters who I didn't. And one of them has a really stable life and a wonderful family structure and support. And my other younger half-sister is now sort of like looking for family and is looking for stability. And because our mom is gone and our parents are gone and they don't have that. And so I think I do inhabit this idea that I am the little mother. Like I am sort of the substitute or replacement for that. And with the help of some therapists, I'm coming to the realization that I can't actually ever be a mother to my sisters. Like I can never actually give them or make up for this love or this person or this role in their life, because also, you know, acknowledging that like no one else can do that for me, right? That idea of sister is something we're trying to figure out what that is or what that means, because we've never been sisters to each other. Like there's always been a more complicated dynamic. And so I've seen, you know, like depictions of it or like read depictions of it. And I think that a lot of people have different ideas about what sisters are or could be. So it really is just a process of figuring out what that means for us. And we're working on it. We're trying.
I so enjoyed Dog Flowers and I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's been really great talking.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineers are Tom Barrich and Spencer Kellum. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.